Epicamin had been built on. When the worst of the rainy season storms had begun to crash into the coast, the city had suffered a series of disastrous rockslides, displacing over half of the city's population. Nearly 2,000 of the evacuees had journeyed on foot to Denisov, but Controller Norshinka, the executive administrator of Denisov, and a man thoroughly bribed by the Venesians, had turned them away. There just wasn't any profit to be had in taking the Tepikamin in. They were a population of fur trappers and deep-sea fisherfolk. This far inland, they were nothing but unskilled labour, as far as the lords were concerned. The fact that they were on foot, with nothing but the clothes on their back, trekking through the most violent weather of the Shokani year, seemed to be irrelevant to them.
"We can all appreciate the Lord Governor's magnanimity."
Minister Soborov's voice was all oily charm.
"Indeed, in the area of personal generosity, her example is a paragon of selflessness many would do well to take heed to."
He never bothered with the amplifiers, as though his words were for the Grevenate alone. If he had a question to ask a witness, he merely mused it aloud to his colleagues, who never failed to relay it to the citizen being questioned. Ostap wagered that Soborov was perhaps the most influential member of the Grevenate who was not themselves a lord, and was one of the only ministers not connected to their lord by blood. Margrave Jorgen Yelansky had appointed Soborov to his vital clerical position nearly 60 years ago after a vicious argument with Lord Ruprecht, after which Jorgen had not voluntarily set foot in Kostovium again. The bitter old patriarch had even refused to come to Ruprecht's funeral, sending his youngest daughter in his stead.
"However," Zorobov continued, "has Lady Ashiel offered to open her palace to these displaced villagers? Has she ordered soldiers to clear houses so that she might have room to house them?"
Minister Soborov was one official Ostap hated hearing from. No matter what the issue, the man could be counted on to say the right thing while doing the wrong thing.
"Living quarters for these evacuees are also needed, and not within the Lord Governor's province to provide. On this scale and at this time, as much as it might pain us to face this truth. 3,000 of the townspeople fled Tepikamin when the cliffs gave way."
Grev Inzigo Hodiuk looked appalled by the tone of the conversation thus far.
"Norshinka's people only reported little more than 2,000 when they were denied refuge in Denisov and sent into the maw of a storm front. Our latest report estimates only 1,600 remain. Are we to sit by and do nothing while the storms scour these people from the face of our planet?"
Grev Hodiuk was young, but a fierce populist. Ostap wasn't particularly surprised. Her family were lumber merchants from Trakovy Bay, where the hard work of logging required the nobles who ran the business to work right alongside the men and women who laboured for them. It bred a lessening of the class divide that crossed the rest of Shokani society.
"Why would you think that these people have perished?"
Irena Venesen's voice crackled from the amplifiers, and hidden within his alcove, Ostap grimaced. Grateful his colleagues across the chamber were too far away to make out his facial expression.
"I've seen no pick steels of drifts of dead bodies. The tech priests of the Pellucidian Troposec monitoring station have not contacted us with reports of corpses raining from the heavens. There are many isolated and unincorporated communities of agrarian workers across the continent. Is it not more likely these refugees have taken shelter with friends or family among those than the wild and baseless claim that they are dropping dead in droves from exposure to a little rain?"
She was skillful. Ostap had to give her that. Grev Hodiuk tried to respond to Irena's barbs, but was drowned out by the laughter of her colleagues. This wasn't the first time he'd seen this dance, and he knew it wouldn't be the last. Irena knew that the best way to lead the Grevs by their nose was to appeal to their treasury, while belittling and patronising any opposition.
"We do, of course, have adequate accommodation for the evacuees," Ostap said when the jeering had died down. The Rovac district currently has several HAB blocks which are sitting vacant, more than enough to house the remaining 1,600 refugees. Or we could let them take their chances on trying to find a pair of farmers with grain silos large enough to house 1,000 people.
There was a murmur of laughter from those on his side, but Ostap could measure the laughter and see the eventual outcome.
The Rovac district has been slated for demolition, Margrave Brazil boomed. It has already been redistricted for a new warehousing facility, which you yourself voted for, if I recall.
What I recall, Ostap said, was that the demolition was scheduled not to begin until 2 years hence. Ergo, there's nothing preventing us from housing the evacuees there. He smiled. He wasn't going to win, but neither did he intend to let the Venaissins and their supporters perform their villainy without being called to task for it.
Nothing, that is, save for the statutes of usury, which would prevent the Venaissin family from collecting rent from temporary tenants of those properties. Nothing except for the fact that none of my esteemed colleagues from the upper tiers can see an easy way to exploit those displaced citizens for their own profit.
The chamber roared with a dozen officials speaking at once. The amplifiers were programmed to accept and respond to primacy and seniority, but so much input at a single time overwhelmed them, reducing the Basilica Grevenator to a cacophony of thunderous voices all melding into a single chaotic storm. The remaining citizens in the Occurium doubled over, their ears covered. Only the sonoblative generators in the alcoves prevented the members of the Grevenate from being deafened. After a few moments, the primacy filters finally managed to kick in.
And is precisely the sort of grandstanding nonsense that perpetually bogs this chamber down in battles of folly.
Longrev Oldermeyer fumed, his face visibly flushed in rage, even through the static-laden hollow display.
A displaced workforce numbering in their thousands, with no means of supporting themselves, quartered in a pauper's tenement and fed on the welfare of the public. All of us, or at least all of us with the wisdom of more than a scant few years, know this to be an ingredient list for a disaster of cataclysmic and generational proportions.
Order is the assigned task and the appointed command, intoned Margrave Ulika Winovic, a woman whose insufferably false piety grated even on her allies. And by idle hands are the labours of heresy performed. I cannot, in good conscience, vote on measures that would see a district of destitution added to my city, with the residents therein condemned to a life devoid of opportunity and doomed to criminality. Ostap tried to speak, to argue, but Lady Gavozny cut him off.
Too right, she said. We must all surely recognise that despite the unfortunate circumstances of their plight, those citizens from Tupikamin are better served in the long run by relocating to somewhere other than the capital. With that said, by the authority of the Basilica Grevenator, I call this issue to vote.
Ostap sighed as the lights across his desk began illuminating, indicating the votes of his colleagues. He tapped the icon to indicate his assent and realised it was never a good sign when he could identify which of the tiny lights was his. One of the few green icons overwhelmed by a sea of red decline votes. He cast his eyes upward to the relief images of the Imperium's militant defenders. The soldier of the Astra Militarum caught his eye, as it had done so many times before. He never stood shoulder to shoulder with such august warriors, of course. He had not knelt in a sandbag fortification as mankind's enemies came slavering forward, determined to fight once again a battle that was almost certainly a foregone conclusion. More and more, however, he felt that his service in the Grevenate gave him, if not an equivalent frame of reference, then a modicum of empathy for those doomed to perish in a losing battle their honour would not let them walk away from.
Great throne on terror,
Ashiel whispered. She'd had no idea a human could hold so much blood. Her would-be assassin had made it out of the labyrinth and to the base of the tight spiral stair. Or perhaps he'd been dragged there. Ashiel stood on the staircase and marvelled at the scene. She didn't even reel in horror. It was as if the carnage were simply beyond her mind's ability to process. Blood, dried and tacky, covered every surface, as if it had been applied not by arterial spray, but with a painter's brush. The corpse, or the bulk of it, lay with limbs askew. The headless remains were so discombobulated that she couldn't begin to guess which stumps had been arms and which had been legs. Lesser portions of meat lay scattered about the torso, foundations for splinters of gleaming bone and tattered strips of dangling skin. Of Lestrovsky's head, there was no sign. She held her torch aloft. In the thin electric light of the mounted luminator globe, she could just make out the edge of the maze. She sighed and picked her way across Lestrovsky's remains. The thought had occurred to her to seal the basement away. If the creature possessed the capacity or intent to go on a killing rampage, it surely would have done so by now, after all. Either it was gone, returned to whence it came, or else it was unable to leave. That second thought was sobering and had given her pause. In the end, she couldn't stomach the thought of sleeping in her father's room, walking by his portrait's unforgiving gaze, and wearing the leaden weight of his ring on her hand without living up to his example to her. She had a responsibility, not only to everyone living in Darkadin, but to those who would live there in the future. She could no more leave such a dangerous creature running loose than she could leave a live grenade lying in a hallway. Her plasma pistol did a great deal to alleviate her anxiety, of course. She wasn't certain what manner of thing had torn Lestrovsky to pieces, but it was a rare beast that could withstand a full burst from such a weapon. If the deacon had spoken true, then the rod of office tucked in her belt was proof against such blasphemies. The circular maze was as frightening as it had been the first time, with its walls as narrow as the sides of a sarcophagus and the vague sense of dripping water somewhere in the darkness. She only needed her navigation trick in part, however. A few of the passages she recognised as dead ends. The thought of the creature wandering lost through the labyrinth occurred to her. But if that was the case, she would have to come up with an alternative plan. Wandering away from the route through the maze, alone in the darkness, wasn't a plan she fancied going through with. Emerging from the maze solved one of the mysteries. The location of Lestrovsky's head. The assassin's visage stared at the mouth of the labyrinth from the remnants of one of the trophy racks. The killer's face was contorted in an agonized scream, and the little round chin extended and warped in a way Ashiel would have thought impossible. Her family had been avid hunters at one point, and the mounted specimens of dozens of animals line the upper levels of Darkadin. She'd always noted in her youth the difficulty of capturing life and emotion in the dead eyes of a trophy creature. Lestrovsky's murderer had no such difficulty, and in fact was a true master of the craft. The assassin's eyes were still bright and clear, wide with terror and wet with torment. Even when he had been prepared to snuff her life, those eyes hadn't betrayed a flicker of emotion to her, and here before her she read a world of pain. Ashiel was shaken from her reverie by the bone-chilling realization that the assassin's face was still moving. A chill touch crept down her spine, rooting her to the fetid stone floor as she watched the eye rolling in its skull. Just before she began to scream, she realised the dead eyes had not been animated by some unholy means. A large drop of blood had merely welled up in the socket and finally spilled from the eye. She shook herself, breathing deep and willing her hammering heartbeat to slow. She didn't know how long she'd stared into Lestrovsky's dead face, but by the time she had calmed down, her joints were stiff and her fingertips cold. She clutched her pistol tighter and stomped past the spiked head to the main chamber. Something was different. Ashiel held her luminator out, trying to determine what was amiss. There were bloody streaks on the ground, evidence of Lestrovsky's terrified and ultimately doomed struggle for life, but it was more than that. There was a brick lying loose on the ground that hadn't been there before. There was a passage, or at least the beginnings of one, leading away from the trophy room in the opposite direction from the oubliette chamber. Scratch marks covered the dirt there. Several other stones and bricks had been dislodged to form a loose pile at the bottom. The creature had been busy. Beyond the damage the creature had inflicted, she spied a vertical shaft, too narrow for anything larger than a rodent to squeeze through. The flow of air told her that it went all the way to the surface. Could the creature squeeze itself through such a passage? If it could travel through the shadows, as she's seen, she wouldn't be surprised. The oubliette room held even more disturbing labour. The geometric runes ringing the stone circle had been cleaned. The cobwebs and dust brushed away from the smooth white material. Each rune had been carefully daubed with a thin coat of blood.
You like my little display?
Ashiel spun, trying to pinpoint the voice. She snapped her pistol up, ready to threaten the creature, only to find the passage behind her occupied by nothing but damp moss and the echo of her fearful breathing. She realised that even the chittering of rodents was absent, and had been since she had ventured through the secret door. The quiet was so total, she began to fear she had imagined the voice. When she turned back to the stone ring, her gaze was met by the hellish pits of the creature gazing back at her. The coal eyes she had seen locked away before were more intense now, the spark brighter and deeper. The brilliant orbs were so hateful she could have sworn they would burn her if she got close enough. She had no idea how it had moved past her without making a sound. The inhuman face was no more than an arm's length from her own, close enough to pounce before she'd even raised her weapon. She shuddered to think how long it had stood behind her, studying her, while she had been menacing an empty passage. The thing stood watching her, but its easy stance didn't fool her. She knew it could move with the speed of a marsh lion if it wished.
The grunting, painted barbarians that used to call these caves home were fond of planting those ridiculous little trophy displays to ward us off.
The voice was smoother, richer than it had been before. Ashiel swallowed, her mind suddenly unable to focus. She couldn't have shot the thing if she wanted to. This wasn't what she'd been expecting. The trophies, the labyrinth, she said, aware that she needed to regain the social footing. They weren't for intruders from the surface, were they? They were supposed to intimidate and obstruct your people. She successfully resisted the urge to turn her head to the stone ring, but her eyes flicked towards it anyway. The thing let out a horrifying sound, a hollow, echoing click that reminded her of a primitive trying to start a fire in a cave by slamming rocks together. The monster's shoulders jutted slightly, and she realised with a start that it was laughing at her.
Yes,
it hissed.
Your kind has always clutched desperately at talismans they think will protect them from us.
It shifted its gaze to her pistol. As if to demonstrate its point, the thing broke away from the shadows and stalked back towards the stone ring, turning its back fully to her. It was as if the darkness swallowed it up. Its form became faded and indistinct. She tried to focus on the ashen grey hair, but after a moment that too was gone in the gloom.
Why are you still here?
Ashiel asked.
I cannot leave,
came the hissing reply. It seemed to echo throughout the room. Ashiel felt a creeping dread up her spine. She knew the thing was trying to unnerve her. She had no intention of playing its childish games.
I find that hard to countenance, she snapped. I think you could be out of the palace and gone from Custodian before anyone even realised you'd been here, if that was your wish. So why remain?
The eyes snapped open again, no more than a handful of paces from where the creature had vanished. It stood in front of the stone ring upon the wall, one hand lifted to trace the runes. It gazed at her over its shoulder, the red eyes now taking on a hateful hue they had not seemed to possess before.
Palace, city, river or caves, they're all still here.
It turned back to the stone ring.
And I cannot leave here until I am bidden to do so.
The creature turned back and cocked its head.
As it has ever been, the emissary serves the pleasure of the chieftain.
Ashel scowled. Explain. The creature clack laughed at her again.
You bear the signet on your hand,
it said.
You wielded the knife that made the offering of flesh and blood. You gave life to reconsecrate the pact.
Ashel's eyes narrowed. So are you bound to my bidding, then? The red eyes flared briefly. In the space of a blink, the thing crossed the distance between them. It stood close enough for her to smell the dry, rotten odour of its skin, like a den of hibernating reptiles. Its arm moved like a striking serpent, snatching her rod of office from her belt. The fiend held it up between them.
No,
it said. For the first time, its tone was not jovial or restrained. She could feel a galaxy of contempt in that word. In what way do you serve my pleasure, then? Ashel knew she had the upper hand, at least for the moment. As fearsome as the creature was, it was prevented from harming her, either by sorcery or necessity. The thing growled with a voice like a drowning gurgle. The eyes burned steady now, and along its black skin she could see a series of heliotrope runes glowing faintly. Here was the truth of it, the cultured and easy demeanour of a thin mask. Beneath lay a predator, alien in thought and body.
Call my name,
it hissed. The cadence and lilt were still alien, but the anger and arrogance were unmistakable, no matter the language.
Make your offering of flesh and blood, of life, and the darkness shall descend where you command, leaving only whom you wish.
And what is your name? She asked.
Jezubiel.
There was no discordant hiss, no pop of displaced air, no dramatic device to signal the fiend's departure. It was just gone. Tanzig slammed the door to the carriage. The previous night had been positively vexing. The wardens had arrested his primary apothecaria in Costovium earlier in the week in a raid that was so well coordinated it had to have been instigated by inside information. Try as he might, Tanzig had been unable to determine who the rat had been. His suspicions had already led to him questioning several of his bagmen, two of them to the point that they would no longer be able to serve his enterprises. He tried to work out his frustrations by visiting his favourite gentry's club, home to one of Costovium's infamous strife societies. Amid the tang of aged amasek and a pall of rich smoke, the wealthiest degenerates of Costovium would gather together to dine and drink in luxury, surrounded by fine art and finer consumables. Under cover of darkness, the most desperate of the city's poor were brought in and enticed to fight for the pleasure of the viewing elite. Sportsmanship and righteous challenge were nowhere to be found. The strife societies operated to turn a profit and provide the audience with entertainment. The rules were irrelevant, the lives of the competitors valued less than beasts, and the terms of each match subject to change at a moment's notice with the offer of enough coin. Even this had failed to assuage Tanzeg's mood, however. Normally the bloodshed at his behest perked him right up, but nothing seemed to relieve his stress. He'd even opened his own purse up to the violence, first paying to have two bare-knuckle brawlers armed with meat cleavers. When their brutal dismemberment of each other failed to satisfy, he'd intervened in another match, paying to have a recurring fighter's legs broken before his bout. Even the boos and the wails of his fellow nobles as they watched the crowd favourite beaten to death by a pair of half-starved street performers could not alleviate his ire. This night didn't appear to be shaping up any better. His date for the evening shivered on the carriage bench next to him. The woman's bench, occupied by his mother and sister, had a heavy down quilt to warm the legs on chill nights. But none of the Venaissons would ever have let a common companion sit with nobility. It was only in the interests of time that they allowed Tanzek's companion into the carriage at all. If they'd been attending a soiree closer to the Venaisson villa, his mother would have insisted he make Marizia walk. He tried to self-medicate to take the edge off, of course. The new supplier he had found for reckoning capsules had proven to be slightly too good at his job. The high had been intense, but it lasted far longer than Tanzek was used to. The sun had been creeping over the horizon before his heart had slowed enough for him to be able to get any sort of sleep at all. And what little he had managed had been light and easily disturbed. And now he had the unenviable task of the governor's ball. Few things were less attractive than spending an evening listening to tired string music and feigning deference to the pretentious child who ruled Darkadon. Of course, there was no experience so loathsome that it couldn't be made more miserable by the presence of his mother and sister. Irena and his mother stared at him as he adjusted his coattails on his carriage bench.
"Are you finished with your little temper fit?"
Acelia said. For the governor's ball, she had chosen an outfit of Anzellian bat silk. The fabric of the gown itself was woven so tightly it looked as though it could be liquid. Her decorative shawl was a far looser weave, like a finely woven fisher's net laid over her bared shoulders. Her hair had been bound with a series of bat silk threads, their gleaming silvery finish contrasting against the steel grey of the matriarch's head. Tanzek said nothing, only slouched in his seat. He had chosen a rib-belly coat over a padded duelist's vest and riding breeches. His creamy white outfit, trimmed with gold and odobenid bone, was the height of expense and ostentation.
"Whatever has got into you?"
asked Irena. She gazed out of the window idly. Tanzek slammed a fist against the back of the carriage. If the driver didn't get moving shortly, he was apt to throw the man to the street and drive them himself. He'd done it before. To many of the ruling families in Costovium, an auto carriage was the pinnacle of wealth and status. Few could afford them, and only the governor could afford to run one for mundane tasks. The Venaissons had always preferred horses. Like his father and his grandfather, Tanzek could wax poetic about the pride of Shokan's animal husbandry, about the dangers of automation, or the superiority of the horse to the auto carriage. It was all too common to meet a petty noble full of pride over their family's new acquisition, and Tanzek enjoyed injecting a bit of humility in their lives. In truth, his preference came down to the fact that he couldn't whip an auto carriage.
"He's embarrassed because his security was breached," said Acelia.
Tanzeg's eyes narrowed. How had she known? Irena pursed her lips quizzically. Their mother went on.
"One of his little narcotic houses was raided, and not by the enforcers. He spent the better part of the last few days trying to figure out who did it."
Tanzek realised that his mother never spoke with such confidence about matters she was ignorant of. If she was putting his business on display, it was because she already knew who had betrayed him. It didn't take him long to come to the obvious conclusion.
"You?"
he asked, turning a wicked eye to his mother. Irena giggled. Acelia ignored her son's outburst and her daughter's taunts.
"Clearly it was warranted," she said. "You've poisoned your mind to powder. How else could your utter failure be explained?"
Tanzek forced his face into a bitter, crazed grin.
"You underestimate me, mother. I'm wounded that you think your own son wouldn't turn a setback to his family's advantage. We haven't been arrested, which means Lestrovsky wasn't taken alive by the governor's forces."
Irena waggled her decorative fan dismissively.
"And yet your minion has yet to make himself known either, which suggests he didn't make it out alive."
Too right.
Tanzeg nodded, reached under his jacket and produced a slim control unit.
It would be a shame, then, if his corpse were to be discovered in the governor's palace.
Irena leaned over to her mother.
He fitted the assassin with an ISO tag, she said.
Acelia continued to look unimpressed.
Which is all well and good if the Matkeson child was foolish enough to keep a rotting cadaver lying about her drawing room for a month after shooting him dead. What are we to do if the body has been removed?
The device tracks the radionuclidic signature of the tag,
Tanzeg said.
All I need to do is begin at the last place I left him, and I should be able to track Lestrovsky all the way to his final resting place. At the very least, to the site of his death, which should be able to produce evidence of his demise.
Acelia scowled.
There will be a great deal of security.
Irena laid an obsequious hand on Acelia's arm.
Please, Mother, she said. I can think of no task that Tanzeg has more practice or talent for than skulking about in a lady's home, unwanted and unnoticed.
She made not a sound, but Tanzeg caught the hitch in Marizia's breath as she bit back a snort of laughter. He wasn't sure if his escort's laughter was at his expense or because she knew things his sister did not. His pride compelled him to believe the former.
That's why I brought a professional, he said. After all, what was it you always said about craftspeople?
Artists, corrected his mother, absently staring at the curtained window.
The windows of their carriages were always heavily draped, all the better to remind themselves and the world around them that there was a wall around the family, an eternal separation between them and the common person.
An artist is only as good as their tools.
She turned and cast a critical eye on Marizia.
And you are a useful tool, are you?
Marizia's face betrayed nothing, but Tanzeg could feel the brief tension in her. He knew she wanted to say something sharp, but wisely refrained.
I should think so, Mum. Good enough to do my job and remain silent about it afterwards, she said.
Tanzeg was glad Marizia hadn't tried to make some snide comment or witty boast. Real professionals never did in his experience.
And can you do your part?
He asked his sister. Irena nodded.
The Gravenet knows that having a ruling family as weak as the Matkesons invites nothing but disaster. Ashiel succeeds now only by walking the most perilous of balancing acts. The nobles need only the flimsiest of tangible excuses to back our installation as the governing family.
She smiled sweetly in a way that made Tanzeg distinctly uneasy. He'd seen that smile before. In their youth, it had usually heralded him being punished for a crime he hadn't actually committed. In adulthood, he had learned it came before far more nefarious turns of fortune.
You have an agent within the Matkeson household, don't you?
He tried for months to plant a solid traitor within the governor's household, or else to flip a loyal supporter. How had his sister got her hooks into the governor's people? And how highly were they placed?
She has a prospect,
Acelia snapped, stealing the momentum from her daughter's gloating.
So far, that seems to be all either of you have. And we cannot build a legacy on ifs and maybes.
Acelia smiled for the first time since Tanzeg had got into the carriage.
How do we build our future?
Tanzeg grimaced and slumped in his seat. As much as he hated Acelia, she was right. In many ways, he supposed he and Ashiel had a great deal in common. Both of them had been shaped by their parents, moulded to fill a certain role since before their birth.
We build our future in the shadows, he said. We do not build with them.
Chapter 7 Jezubiel watched the human breathe. There was no one else in the room to see it, but it clung to the shadows, drawing them about itself like a cloak out of habit. The chamber was small, but warm, and smelled faintly of herbs. The old woman, her frame bent and gnarled, slumbered fitfully beneath layers of woven blankets. Someone had laid out a thoughtful, if useless, bouquet of wildflowers across the crone's stomach. It had never seen her face before. But Jezubiel knew this woman. It knew her intimately, in fact. Just as a man stranded on a darkened plain would fixate upon a light source so faint he would never otherwise notice, or have his ear drawn to the sound of a pin drop when locked in a mausoleum, so Jezubiel's incarceration had sharpened its senses. Locked away in its oubliette, it had been able, after a time, to sense the hurts of those far overhead. It had never been a replacement for devouring the pain of someone close at hand. Or, muses forbid, the pains caused by its hand. But it had sufficed. The pain of those who dwelled in the palace had been its crust of bread, the trickle of water down the wall of its cell that had sustained it. Like that life-sustaining trickle, it had lapped at such pains, savouring every minute drop. Sharp, sudden pains, even very intense ones, were often gone so quickly that there was nothing of them to consume by the time Jezubiel had felt them. It was the familiar pains that had been the best. How many times had this woman scrubbed stones with fingers swollen with arthritis? How many times had she bent on her scabbed and creaking knees to clean a forgotten pantry, a shelf that no one would see, in a labour which would never be appreciated? How many times had she sat sipping lukewarm tea because her teeth were too thin and worn to bear the brunt of a hot drink? The thing of shadow loomed over the bed, inhaling the rich scent of the woman's discomfort. Even in slumber, her ancient limbs pained her. Her head ached, the bones soft and yielding where the butt of a pistol had cracked them. What few thoughts remained to her were fearful, resentful, and agonized. Jezubiel clicked a soft laugh to himself. It was funny, it thought. It had spent so many years lamenting that it only had her to feed on, and when it was finally released, with an entire city of torments to delight in, it was to her it returned. Her pain was a flavour it had only tasted from afar, and now that it was so close, it was a welcome delight beyond anything it could have imagined. A thin and simple meal, but one that had teased its senses for nearly 100 years. Empathy was unknown among its people, among the freezing, lightless void of its home, where every shadow hungered and the grief worms called their mockery of the dead. Feelings that warm the soul called out like a beacon to the predators of the realm. And in that realm, everything was a predator. Jezubiel couldn't construct any true sympathy for the bedridden old woman. Still, it felt a closeness to her. She had been a familiar, if distant, presence for many years. Empathy might be beyond its remit, but selfish possessiveness was not. It pained it that she could no longer serve its needs. The thought that she might perish, and not at its hands, sparked a cold anger within it. With one blackened talon, Jezubiel stroked the withered, sunken cheek. The thin flesh twitched at its touch, and the old servant moaned in her sleep. Jezubiel's lips parted over its seed-pearl teeth, and it faded back against a wall. There might yet be a way she could serve it, it realized. It was the minutiae that dragged Alida down. Ashiel's father hadn't told her that. He hadn't needed to. His example showed it to her every day. For every major decision, every crisis, there were 100,000 matters of trivia. She hadn't been governor for a month before she lost track of the number of routine approvals, denials, and authorizations she had signed or notarized. Henrik sighed as he scanned the bookshelf in her office. Behind her desk, Ashiel smiled. How many times had Ruprecht heard a similar sigh from one of his family as he sat behind that desk, buried beneath a mountain of bureaucratic incidentals? More than she could count, Ashiel would wager. That's what had made him an excellent governor. He had never shirked, never faltered, never knocked off early with a scheduled task undone to go fowling or play with his children. Rain or shine, ill or healthy, he had done his duty. "The crowd is already amassing for your banquet," said Henrik. "Dranata must have been very busy." Achille glanced up from her paperwork. Her brother had eschewed the arbitrator armour for the evening, instead going with a quilted slash doublet and matching hose in a soft blue-grey colour. The style was unconventional, probably Sorinusian, but his outfit was civilised enough. By luck or design, he'd chosen a colour that matched their houses. She'd noted he had even found a decorative holster for his auto pistol with the Matkeson arms embossed in silver. Asha winced. She realised she'd forgotten to tell Henrik what had happened to Drenata.
"Unfortunately not," she said. "Drenata is still recovering."
Her brother turned, not quite comprehending. "Still recovering?" She nodded.
"The injuries she suffered during the assassination attempt were more severe than was first believed," she said. "I've made her comfortable, but my Medicaid tells me she's suffered severe brain damage, and it's unlikely she'll ever wake."
The notion of providing Drenata with the best care available had never been in question. Unlike so many other issues she dealt with, she didn't have to ask what her father would have advised her to do. Drenata had given the bulk of her life in service to the governor's household, and making sure she was cared for was the least Achille could do to honour her service. Henrik grimaced and turned back to the bookcase. Few on Shokan had welcomed him back, Achille knew. Having one of the few who had opened their hearth to him taken away had to sting. She supposed that her brother had been so treated throughout his life that he probably considered the feeling typical by now. Drenata had always had an extra moment to spare for the well-being of the children in the palace, but Achille was beginning to suspect she had doted on Henrik.
"It's a shame," he said. "It would have been nice to see a friendly face, or at least feel their presence."
"Should I take that to mean that Judge Idanel will not be attending?"
Achille smiled as Henrik turned back to her, to show her brother she was teasing him.
"Or does that mean your meeting with him went less than spectacularly?"
Henrik straightened his belt, frowning. She wondered if he realised how much he looked like their father in that moment. She knew that look. The stern, patrician glare as he tried to fight back a decidedly unprofessional comment.
"Judge Idanel will not be attending," he said.
Achille could tell he was fighting himself on whether or not he should say more to her. A quandary of duty to his position against duty to his family. If voicing a negative opinion of his superior gave him this much difficulty, how much worse might it be if he was forced to intervene professionally? Achille signed one of the documents in front of her. A routine authorization for grain shipments to the Calistonian Haven. The key to getting men like Henrik and her father to open up was to give them an out.
"I've yet to meet him, of course," she said. "In my preparations for the possibility of his attendance this evening, I've had to rely on Father's notes."
She shuffled the request to the other side of her desk, studiously avoiding Henrik's sudden gaze.
"He seemed to be of the opinion that Idanel had no interest in the goings-on of Shokan."
Henrik cleared his throat and shuffled uncomfortably. There it was. Confirmation of all she needed to know.
"With regards to what matters, or rather, that is, in the broader sense of the Imperium at large," Henrik said, caught between honesty and offending a planetary governor and his own sister to boot. "The Calistonian takes up a greater portion of attention than, or rather, the affairs of..."
"A relatively minor world," Achille offered, "relative to the Imperium as a whole."
Henrik visibly relaxed.
"Quite."
Achille signed the last of the documents and pushed back from her desk.
"Henrik," she sighed, "I'm not as self-deluded as the Council of Nobles. I may not have been educated on Sorinu, but I have enough awareness to know that Shokan is only a very small part of the Imperium as a whole. I'm sure the judge has more than enough to occupy his time on the Calistonian."
Henrik shook his head.
"It isn't so much that, but the Calistonian is where the bulk of traffic comes through. I know it looks like a slight, but if anything, it's a credit to Father's administration that the arbitrators need pay so little attention to the planet."
Achille gave herself a last check in the mirror before leaving. She allowed Henrik to open the door for her, but made sure it was she who locked the door. After the intrusion, she couldn't trust anyone.
So, in your opinion, what is the likelihood of the arbitrator being drawn into a power struggle?
She asked as they walked. Henrik kept his eyes forward. Very small, he said. Idunnell has managed to stay out of politics of the noble houses for decades and has every intention of keeping it that way. So long as the tides keep coming and whoever occupies Darkerton continues to give him a plausible veneer of stability, he isn't going to get involved.
You seem like you disapprove, said Ashiel.
Henrik grimaced again. It's not my place to approve or disapprove of the judge's methods of operation, he said.
But if it was?
Her question brought her brother up short. He stopped walking for a moment, weighing whether to be honest with her or not. If I were in Judge Idunnell's position, he said cautiously, I might be more inclined to pay greater attention to the goings-on of Shokan.
He started walking again, refusing to look Ashiel in the eye.
Of course, my superiors would rightly question whether my interest was motivated by personal spite, which is why I would never be allowed to serve on Shokan.
That was as it ever had been. The truth was that the political warfare of Shokan was relatively small-time. She knew that on worlds like Sorinyu, the monolithic bulwarks of the ancient Adeptus organizations ground against one another in titanic clashes, struggles that might leave thousands or even millions dead as a result of a petty dispute between rival functionaries. Shokan had none of that. Their sole arbitrator cared little for the world. The Adeptus Mechanicus and the Administratum both considered the Calistonian Haven to be their primary concern, and kept the bulk of their forces there. The Adeptus Astra Telepathica did not even have an office on Shokan, apparently considering the world too insignificant to bother with a standing contingent of sanctioned psychers trained to send and receive interstellar communication. Her household staff had the only assigned astropath on the entire planet, although she knew a few of the wealthier noble houses were able to afford private astropaths of their own. She was glad that Henrik was walking with her. The halls of Darkerton had begun to change their tone for her. Where she had once drawn strength from their immensity, the upswept arches reminding her to lift her head, the ancient stone foundations that had borne her people for millennia lending strength to her feet, she now walked them with trepidation at best. The vaulted ceilings were never completely lit. How could they be? Each darkened hallway she passed was a potential hiding spot. Each shadowy recess was the home for an imagined set of lurking eyes. Her unseen stalker watched her from the shadows, she knew. And in Darkerton there was nothing but shadows to hide in.
I'm afraid I simply must slip away, ladies.
Tanzeg smiled at the simpering noble women vying for his attention.
My companion needs a little air, and what sort of escort would I be if I didn't accompany her?
He prodded Marizia to move, smiling all the while. His companion smiled and curtsied. A skilled actress, Marizia did not give away the slightest clue that she didn't belong to this world. Her skillful, cold reading of the guests allowed her to navigate conversations about art, politics and finance with practiced ease. She gave no reason for any of them to believe she was anything other than a new money merchant's daughter, or distant cousin of one of the Grevenet, in Costovium for the ball, and infatuated perhaps with the eldest Venesan scion. Tanzeg led Marizia through the side halls, tugging at her arm insistently. This was why he had brought her. No one would question a spoiled son of privilege stealing away to a side room with his lady friend. Governor Matkison was busy receiving official supplicants, and the rest of the guests were too busy plotting to stab one another in the back to care. Tanzeg found the narrow staircase down into the footman's hall where he had pursued Ashiel with Ostrovsky. He would have been capable of blustering his way through any mundane servant challenging him, but none did.
Wait here,
he said to his companion. Marizia had served her purpose, and while she was useful, he certainly didn't trust her. He reached into his dueling vest and produced his ISO tracker. The piece of tech was ancient, but faithful yet. The screen flickered to life and began cycling through tracking arcs. He heard the sound of footsteps coming down the hall, but didn't break his cool. Holding the ISO tracker low against his leg, he used his free hand to pull a low stick from his breast pocket and lit it while leaning against the wall. After a moment, a pair of servants came around the corner, carrying a tray of finger sandwiches between them. Tanzeg ignored them. After they were gone, he checked back with his ISO tracker to discover that it had returned a hit. Not only that, it was close. Tanzeg smiled to himself and set off down the hallway. The ISO tracker was as eager for its task as Tanzeg himself was. Other nobles might eschew performing their own labour, and for menial tasks Tanzeg was no different. When it came time to enact the malevolent schemes of his family, however, Tanzeg preferred to act himself. The last time he had visited, Lostrovsky had tried to convince his employer not to accompany him into the palace. Then, as ever, Tanzeg had insisted on being part of the action. When it came to the inflicting of pain and the snuffing of life, men like Lostrovsky were mere functionaries. Tanzeg was an artist. The cold, whistling servants' corridors were the things of dreams. The Venetian's palace had servants' corridors as well, but they were small, tight, and functional, with plaster walls and no embellishments. Darkadon had been built in a much older time, and its support structure showed it. The buttresses, arcing overhead, put to mind the ribs of a great beast. Its long-deceased corpse turned to the purpose of a new generation now living in its shadow. The heat of the great halls could never penetrate these side corridors, not completely, and they held a palpable chill. The small fireplaces of the footmen's parlours, where servants could rest and take their meals, would alleviate the cold somewhat. But even then, the air was crisper here than in the rest of Darkadon. He grinned wolfishly. Without someone tending to them regularly, the walls and floor would become slick with condensation. A film of moss would grow over the whole length. Great arachnid webs would dominate the arches overhead. If Tanzeg had ever needed any proof that he and the holier-than-thou woman upon the throne were cut from different cloth, then these corridors proved the question beyond a doubt. When these halls were his, he marvelled, what a spectacle they would be. The ISO tracker led him to the door where he'd bludgeoned the old maid, which wasn't a surprise. At one point, the door had been bound shut by a lock of staggering complexity, a technological marvel the likes of which he'd never before seen. The digital screen of the device was blank, its machine spirit dead and gone, no doubt at Lostrovsky's hand. Tanzeg ran a finger along the exposed guts of the device.
"What delightful apostasy were you up to?" he whispered.
"To defile a relic of the Mechanicus." He'd known Lostrovsky was a bloodthirsty little pervert, but he didn't realise him capable of such blasphemy. Tanzeg scanned the hallway in either direction. He heard the sound of distant echoes, but that was to be expected. There was nothing immediate. He pulled his set of lockpicks from his jacket and went to work on the lock. It was a monster. Ashiel's archaic and irreplaceable biolock may have been destroyed, but she had at least been wise enough to replace it with a formidable, if wholly mechanical, replacement. The lock and chain were too thick to even consider cutting through, even if he'd had tools to do so. But Tanzeg was one of the wealthiest people on Shokan, and one of the many toys his fortunes had supplied him was a set of crystalline lockpicks of surpassing craftsmanship. He didn't know where they came from, only that the smuggler who had sold them to him had later been arrested aboard the Calistonian Haven for possession of Xenos artifacts. What he did know was that they had never failed him, and seemed to amplify his own perception and dexterity when he was using them. The lock gave way eventually, as every obstacle eventually did for Tanzeg. He was only mildly surprised to find a hidden storeroom behind the door. The portrait of General Tarasant gave him pause, and he idly examined the room's contents. A low table held a small brick of obscura, a trio of gladstones in a woven basket, and a tiny shard of red glass wrapped in tissue paper. Now there was a surprise. As straight-sewn as the Matkesons were, it seemed that even they had a taste for the illegal. He moved through the room, examining the contents in greater detail. A uniform from the traitorous Haradni Militarum officers that had tried to infiltrate the Calistonian Haven during the reign of the first Matkeson. A watercolour from one of the insidious Enclave, an infamous group of artists executed for heresy in centuries past. A collection of tokens bearing the sigils of the Tau Empire. He sighed. Nothing really interesting. His own hideaway cellar had far more eccentric artefacts. Still, the presence of such a vault could cause a great deal of concern for the new governor if he were to find a way to reveal its existence. He thought about pocketing one or two items to blackmail her, but dismissed the thought out of hand. Nothing here was so offensive that it would warrant a real investigation. Nothing so egregious that it couldn't be explained away as a heretical item that had been confiscated and then forgotten about. Tanzeg turned his attention back to his tracker unit, which showed the isotope trail from the slave tag passing through the wall of the vault. Shifting the table aside revealed the hidden door, and Tanzeg almost laughed. He produced the illuminator globe from his pocket and made his way cautiously down the staircase. A vault of heresy wasn't so shocking. He'd been more surprised not to find one in the home of a ruling family. Although the lower-class grebs could hardly boast any heresies worth speaking about. A hidden dungeon, though, that was something far more interesting. His experienced nose detected the scent of offal long before he reached the bottom of the staircase. He recognised the distinct squelch as his boots left the stairs and sank into something gelatinous at the bottom. He lowered his luminator globe to his knees, curious as to what could be scattered about down here. "Well, that's interesting," he said. He recognised Lestrovsky's silly little spectacles, the lenses smeared with a thin, greasy film. The rounded end of a tibia protruded from a slab of rotting meat a hand's breadth away. He scanned the ground slowly, mentally accounting for most of his servant's remains. How delicious! He'd suspected the Matkesons had some sort of dark secret from the outside world, but this was beyond his wildest expectations. To the warp with what his mother wanted. If Ashiel was capable of this, he would be willing to play the long game. He'd shift tactics, present a more charming front, but he would find a way to win her heart. He held his luminator aloft and set off through Lestrovsky's remains. He was curious what Ashiel had done with his assassin's head. He couldn't begin to guess what she could have used it for, but he found the very idea that she had absconded with it more interesting than anything else she'd ever done. The labyrinth was intriguing. Fortunately, Lestrovsky had left a trail for him to follow, most likely unintentionally, as the trail consisted largely of the assassin's own blood, but the venison heir could overlook that. It looked as though Lestrovsky might have been worth his hiring fee after all. If there was anything that Ashiel truly appreciated about the Adeptus Mechanicus, it was their devotion to efficiency. Where all her other dutiful citizens had come with fawning assurances of loyalty or unctuous attempts to hitch their fortunes to her own, the representative of the priesthood of Mars had been blunt, curt, and dryly technical. "Would you think less of me if I confessed I didn't understand a word of that?" Henrik asked. He kept his voice low, but Ashiel couldn't suppress a smile. "I caught something about oceans?"